Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me this week, with me, Cam Rusland. This week there is BFM's very own Lee Treeland.
Hello.
Hello, and we have a returning champion, theatre impresario and preserver of the arts of the East Coast, Edin Koo.
Good to be back.
Good to have you. Our three topics will be this week are, is theatre a safe place? Topic number two is, after 2016, who's left? And finally, topic number three is post-truth. So recently in New York, in Broadway land, there is a play going on called Hamilton, which is like the biggest musical like forever. Lynn is looking at me with anger because she is the biggest fangirl of Hamilton. She wants to be talking about it.
For years I've asked.
Right.
No.
Now, Hamilton is about, well, you're the fangirl, Lynn. What's it about?
Well, Hamilton tells the story of one of the founding fathers of the United States, Alexander Hamilton, essentially in the form of a hip-hop musical. And that's a very simplistic way of putting it because it's really layered and beautiful and contemporary and diverse, and it's spectacular.
Okay, so stop gushing for 1 second.
You would not, if you'd given me 7 minutes.
So, but recently, the soon-to-be vice president, Pence, what is his first name?
Mike Pence
went to see the show. And the cast of the show at the end of it, one of the cast anyway, spoke to him from the stage directly to the vice president to say, we don't feel confident and happy about the future, and we hope that you will be the presidency for everybody. So Donald Trump then tweets back to say that theater is supposed to be a safe place, and they must apologize. Now, I'm wondering, does Donald Trump have a point? Is theater supposed to be a safe place? Is what they did, I don't know, rude? My actual argument against what they did was that, for me, the play is the thing wherein we shall prick the conscience of the king. If the play can speak on the subject, then no more words beyond that afterwards need to be said. It's breaking down the importance of the play itself. So I'm just wondering, you're a big fangirl?
I am. And also, it's worth noting that this happened after the final curtain call. I mean, this happened after the play is in all senses technically over. You're only still sharing a room. That's really all there is. So they chose the end of the play, the very end, after it's all done, to do this. Point A. Point B, and I think this is an important one. If anything, the audience, who is the one factor you can't really control in this, the audience was far more disruptive, I think, than one actor speaking to one man as he was departing this theatre, because it was the audience who interrupted with applause at the line, immigrants, we get the job done. It was the audience who, you know, had an ovation mid-song because of the line, do you know how hard it is to lead, in one of the songs. And it was the audience who booed when he walked into the theater. So should theater be a safe space? I think that's a debatable sentiment in some ways. And also, how do you control the audience? I don't think, you know, this happened at the end. This happened after all the other times that the audience was disruptive because Mike Pence was there. Mm. So I don't know.
Well, there's a precedent to this. In the 1960s, Peter Cook... Mm-hmm. Peter Cook, that legendary
British satirist.
Yeah, British satirist with just the most remarkably vicious tongue, was, I can't remember the group now, with Peter Sellers and a whole lot of them doing a
Beyond the
a
Fringe.
Review, Beyond the Fringe.
Yeah.
Doing a review somewhere in the West End, and Harold Macmillan happened to go and...
The then Prime Minister.
The then Prime Minister, Tory Prime Minister, who represented the old oligarchs. And the Queen, actually, I think the newly crowned Queen, very young at that time, and she apparently had a ball. But Peter Cook chose to improvise and you know, proceeded to deliver this scathing satire on this old dead man sitting in the Prime Minister's chair. What, of course, was interesting was that it was done during the midst or the course of the play. And this was essentially an act of heckling after the play was over. Trump has been very interesting to me simply because I think a lot of the, you know, how the Oprah liberals have transformed and transmogrified almost.
Sorry,
the Oprah liberals.
What's an Oprah?
Well, an Oprah liberal, basically, you know, your safe seat liberal, who's suddenly been so shocked by this turn of events, have transformed into this kind of heckling riffraff. This mob, yeah. Who aren't able to basically face up to the fact that there are other voices, there are other constituencies with other concerns, and have taken to this kind of, well, really quite awful behavior.
So, I don't know, thumbs up or thumbs down for the behavior, for the speaking directly to...
I think the speaking directly to... They saw an opportunity to speak directly to power and they took it. If you wanted to leave the room when they were doing it, you could have. You would have seen the play and you would have had whatever impact you had of it and you can go. So this was just an opportunity that they took. My question is, I guess what Eden was raising, which is, what's wrong with the audience in some ways? Yeah. You know, they're booing a fellow audience member. They are the ones who are trying in their own way to express something in rage to a fellow audience member. It's the audience, I think, that was the problem.
Yeah, there's a good phrase that has come out of all this. The intolerance of the tolerant is a phrase that is being used now to describe liberal reactions to, you know, the Trump effect.
One quick question though to you, Eden. You obviously spent a lot of time looking at theater in your day, and also Wayan Kulit in particular. Now, Wayan Kulit, is that a political platform for a political message, or is that just sort of people's entertainment?
It's political in the sense that I think the stage is often a very good space for deflating power, all the ego and the arrogance that comes with power. As you know, I'm often saying to political friends of mine, when people laugh at you, you are really bereft of any kind of power. That's the most dangerous kind of thing you have if people laugh at you. This was not laughter. This was essentially a lot of bad behavior.
Polemic.
And a lot of, not even polemic. I mean, it's just bad behavior.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, if I'd been in the audience, I don't think I would have booed. And I'm not sure if I would have enjoyed the play quite so much. Lynn, I'm sorry. I did listen to a lot of it.
Have you seen it? I haven't seen it,
but I've kind of been trying to absorb everything that I can to kind of see it by proxy. I mean,
you know the soundtrack inside out.
I know that inside out. I've seen whatever clips I could have watched of whatever live performances they've put up. I've read the book. They released a book about the process of putting the whole thing together. And that's kind of like being there, but not quite.
Yeah, it's a lot of rap.
And Hamilton was a very intriguing character.
He was. Yeah. That's the thing. Thank you, Eden. See, someone gets it.
Okay, moving on. Sorry, Lynn, and it's enough Hamilton for now.
It's enough Hamilton always, apparently.
Eden, 2016, Leonard Cohen just died. Who's left?
Absolutely devastating news. I mean, I've loved this man since I was in my teens. And, you know, I've been going around telling people, well, without Leonard Cohen, I wouldn't have known how to live. And that's absolutely true. So, you know, personally, just very sad. But, you know, we have to be zen about it. And, you know, my rabbi is gone. But we let him go in peace. But, you know, it's been a year of essentially deaths. William Trevor, the novelist, died. You know, Wajda died a couple of months ago. It's David Bowie.
Oh,
Prince,
thank you. I was waiting to see.
David Bowie, of course, was.
I feel like this is a support group of sorts. I'm worried about you both.
I'm a huge David Bowie fan. I mean, for years, when I was 14, 15, I had lipstick and I darkened my eyes and I wear those suits.
Cool.
And I took a bus down to Singapore to see the Let's Dance tour when I was 14, 15 years old. Played truant, took a bus, slept in the bus stop and came back the next day. So, but I think, you know, the big question, there's a lot of mourning. It's been a year of mourning and it's kind of interesting to penetrate what that mourning is about. And I think a lot of it is about, well, what's left. You know, in the arts, what is left in creative life, what's left in the imagination, not very much.
But we are.
It seems.
But Eden, you and I, we're of a certain age, so our heroes and heroines are older than us, and they're coming to. I mean, they didn't necessarily live great, healthy lifestyles. But I mean, I don't know, but you know, young people are having their new, creating their new heroes now. They have new David Bowies, new Leonard Cohens. Do they?
Kanye
not?
West.
For some people, Kanye. I mean, people talk about, you know, Biggie Smalls. It's like, you know, that's a big deal.
Well, yeah, and I think those people are. I do think that heroes are taking different shapes and forms. And also, it's kind of easy in some ways. Or you didn't have to sit at the end of Leonard Cohen's life to call him a great. You could have done that 20 years ago. You could have done that 30 years ago. And in the case of Kanye West, and I'm not going to, you know, make the case for Kanye, even though I am a fan, because that would take too long. But in the case of Kanye West, he's been around 10, 15 years. It is too soon to say for some. I mean, we're calling people, I think at this stage, we're kind of looking around and saying, would be greats, could be greats, but you can't definitively sit here and say, yes, I know what's left. Kanye is going to, I would never say Kanye would fill the hole of Leonard Cohen. Kanye is going to fill the hole of David Bowie. Yeah. But it is too soon to say. We're kind of living in that age where fandom is still just fandom before you hit the point where you can say, this person is my guiding light.
Well, so yes, Eddie.
No, I think we're talking about indelibility. You know, and there seems to be, you know, so much of what is, we're talking about creative life here. And creative life is a very elemental aspect of our lives. And I think one of the things that people grieve is the fact that, you know, that aspect of creative life is, has now been consumed by a careerism of a kind, things that are transient and transitory. And we don't have that individual voice and that individual phrasing that, you know, many of these people who have passed were made of. Yeah.
You say careerism, meaning, I suppose, you know, just looking to create a career and make the money and have a wonderful life. I don't know if any of you, did any of you watch Vinyl, the HBO series? It wasn't very good.
The now discontinued, I think.
It was not good. But at the beginning, it did pick up on something, which was it, by focusing and being set in the 70s and around the places like the Chelsea Hotel in New York, where Leonard Cohen lived for a long time, I think.
Yes.
And the thing about the 70s, it had a grit, it had a decay, and it also had baby boomers coming of age. Whereas now, we're so plush. We want plush, and we can access if we have enough money that. Whereas for the likes of the Leonard Cohens and who was he having an affair with for a very long time in Chelsea Hotel? I can't remember.
Janis Joplin. He wrote one song. They didn't have an affair. He wrote one song.
Right. You know, I mean,
it's a very sad song. Can I just say?
We are ugly, but we have the music. It's just.
But there was ugliness all around, and that was all. That was the only option that was to be had.
You know, one of the things, you know, on the day he died, we did a poetry reading. Two wonderful poets from Eastern Europe, one from Poland and one from Macedonia, came down. And I thought it was just a very nice gesture to dedicate that evening's reading to the memory of Leonard Cohen, especially because he was so huge in Eastern Europe at a time when, you know, any kind of foreign music was not allowed. And the great paradox was, as his career was fading in Western Europe, it was starting to really take on new life in Eastern Europe. And he used to perform in places like Bucharest and Budapest and, you know, wonderfully evocative landscapes for his music. And they never banned him because many of people who were in the Secret Service, for example, were big fans of his. So they allowed him to come through. I think one of the things I'm talking about is the intersection of history with creative life. You know, last session we spoke about Dylan and you know, there were people criticizing him for the criticizing the Nobel Committee for that. And I made a remark, you know, when you've stood next to Martin Luther King and sang at the Million Man March, you don't really need to prove much anymore. And I think this, when we talk about artistry of the 20th century in particular, beginning with blues and jazz and Louis Armstrong, you know, performing in dingy bars and then having to sleep in his car because he wasn't allowed a hotel room when he performed with Bing Crosby. The intersection, I think, between history and the creative life is starting to disassemble, and there's a disconnect now.
And you know why Hamilton is such a big hit?
Mm-hmm.
because it represents that intersection in a very real way. I think that in a racially divided America and an America that has seen, you know, really ugly politics being played out, there's something to be said about this story in particular, the story of Alexander Hamilton, who was an immigrant, who rose to power, who had hubris, you know, who is in many ways a tragic hero. He had a flaw, there are all these different things being told in a contemporary language of hip-hop, which may not be for you, Cam, but there is something to be said about Hamilton in that sense, because when you were speaking about Leonard Cohen there, Ed, and, you know, the person who came to mind, who's often being spoken about now as a genius songwriter in the same way, maybe we don't talk about him enough because we don't hear him on the radio, but Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote the words and the music for Hamilton, is being recognized in the same way as a person who is also kind of a Renaissance man of sorts. He, you know, he writes for different formats, he writes for different times. And my point is, we won't know, right? We won't know until 40 years from now.
But I agree, there is this aura building up around him, which is very similar to the gods of the 70s.
Which we're not seeing in, let's say, rock and roll in the same way. Because in some ways, the bands that we're seeing today idolize the Mick Jaggers and the Leonard Cohens and the Bob Dylans. So unless there is something in them, they're always going to be pale shadows of it. And we're always going to see that. But somebody who's kind of going, yeah, hip-hop musical, the guy who's on the turntable, yeah, sure, I'll do that. That kind of offbeatness, I think, is what makes for this spark.
Yeah. Finally, though, you started off by asking the question, what's left? Who is left? I would say we need to prepare ourselves for Joni Mitchell.
Oh, yes. Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan.
Any of the Rolling Stones. Although Rolling Stones' last album, my God, really absolutely awful.
Well, yeah, but come on.
They have another one coming out. I'm not looking forward to it.
And Van Morrison released a new one that was a terrible album, too. But, you know, this is something about raw human emotion. I think one of the great series of albums that was released in the past 10, 15 years were the last Johnny Cash albums. This was a man who just had, you know, going blind, and he just had throat, basically, to deliver these songs. And I think I don't think you can, that level of raw human emotion, where things like a good voice became totally irrelevant, whether it's Dylan, whether it's Leonard Cohen. I think that kind of thing we are not able to feel and tap into very much anymore.
Yeah. Well, epic performers living in epic times.
Yeah.
But in a moment, though, we will go from one extreme to the other with post-truth here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%, APR 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Lee Chui Lin, and Edin Koo. So now, Lin, Trump was voted the president.
President-elect, I like to call him. Right. It just kind of softens the blow.
Right. In an age which is being described as post-truth.
Yes. So the Oxford English Dictionary recently declared post-truth as their word of 2016. I don't know how seriously we want to take this. I mean, 2015's word of the year was an emoji. So there are these different things happening. But it did declare post-truth as the word of the year. And post-truth kind of describes this state in which, I guess, objective fact is not as important as how people feel about things. You know, it's truth is, in that sense, not relevant anymore. And what this made me think about is, of course, not just President-elect Donald Trump, who ran on a platform of post-truth, essentially, but also I wonder whether truth can still compete with post-truth. Is there a way for that competition to become fair again? You know, do people who think in truth need to speak in post-truth? I mean, where are
we
at right now? I don't know. Maybe we just need to make everything all about the feels. I don't know.
Because, I mean, let's say, take an example. Trump said he's going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. Now, how is that post-truth?
Well, it's post-truth in that he's feeding on a fear of immigrants that is not based in truth. It's based in feeling. Yeah.
And no matter what you tell anybody, it's like, no, you know.
They're taking our jobs. They're bringing in disease.
Can you then tackle that with, no, you can't. You can't, because emotion is a very powerful force. It's far more powerful than knowledge.
I think one of the things about post-truth is that the notion of truth was very tenuous anyway.
Sure.
The idea that there was a truth by which you mean there is a form of conduct to play politics, there's a certain kind of language, you know, in which you interact upon this field, I think has been shattered. I think it's been totally shattered. The thing about Trump, for all his, I'm no way a supporter. I mean, the guy's incredibly vulgar and horrible. But I think there is a need now to get over the shock and to really try and examine, you know, the voices that actually spoke. I was quite appalled, for example, at leading liberal media who also engage in their own kind of post-truth. And that was to be in absolute denial that this man had a chance. You know, when it was very well known that he had a tremendous grassroots movement, not all of whom are hicks and rednecks. You know, Bruce Springsteen actually did a very good interview, and he was asked about this. And he says, well, you know, there are all kinds of people that come to listen to my music. And there are many of them who are going to be voting for Donald Trump because they are the people I'm singing about. The BBC did some very good coverage, actually on-the-ground coverage, talking to steel workers and to iron plant workers and so on. And I was so impressed at the level of their political opinion and maturity. And these are people, you know, who are not engaging in any kind of subliminal truth, post-truth. They are dealing with very serious systemic issues.
Very immediate issues.
Very immediate.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that even employing the term post-truth is patronizing and self-defeat.
I think it is trying to create a climate of delusion that doesn't exist.
Well, I'm not entirely sure. This is purely anecdotal, but I have a lot of, you know, friends on Facebook, hundreds of them. I don't know half of them. And I'm always following. And I found that it was getting increasingly more and more cluttered with ridiculous conspiracy theories. Everybody was putting up, and you got to look at this. Oh, my God, this is true. And then stuff about Rothschilds and Illuminati and just nonsense. But I have noticed since Trump came to power, they've completely disappeared. It's gone to zero. Apart from there are two people who are diehard, kind of like, I'll let them carry on. But really, it's gone to zero. I've got a feeling it's like with a lot of people, Trump winning was a big surprise. It's like the dog that barks at every car and has finally caught one. Now, the truth is that actually you can, a crazy person, let's not call him crazy, what did I call him? A demagogue or whatever, can win. The vote will not be stolen from him.
I think going beyond Donald Trump, scary though the man is, there is also this issue of 2016 is scary because, yes, a lot of people we love have died. But it's also scary because we're seeing the world kind of unleash a level of rage that for some of us feels unfounded. You know, why are you so scared of other people? For example, that's a very simple question. And yet that seems to be this sort of, well, I feel scared and that should be enough for you, you know? And so it feels as if we are letting the world feel too much in some ways. And that's the whole notion of post-truth, that we're letting, that you're being led by I feel rather than I know or I think.
Also, I think all the channels for expressing and venting this kind of thing has been very much left to, again, the Oprah liberals. So, you know, we seem to be controlling all the channels to express this sense of anxiety and this sense of siege, and that we all, you know, and one of the very revealing things is about, I mean, there's lots now being written about how, you know, it is the liberals who gave Trump the victory.
Yep.
And I think there's a great deal of truth to that, because really a lot of liberal life is lived in a delusional and cocooned landscape. I mean, I think we talked about this last time. I was sure 6 months ago that he would win.
Yeah,
you know, because he had a hand on the pulse of the grassroots. You see, and it's not all about building walls to shut out immigrants and so on. It is about the system that is not serving people. And Hillary Clinton was perhaps the best manifestation of what that system was about.
Yeah, sure.
And now, you know, it was Richard Nixon in 1970, it was Nixon nonetheless, who said the system is a wild horse. Even I can't tame it. Mm. And I think what we've arrived now is a kind of implosion of the system, because what the conspiracy theorists are talking about now is whether the system will allow Donald Trump to be president. You know, that's a very interesting conspiracy that is now.
Yes, sure. No,
up.
Absolutely. It's bound to happen. But can I just ask, so if we live in a post-truth world, there was presumably a truth time. And I think that if there was, it was a very short-lived period. Because I spent a lot of time doing historical research and reading newspapers from the 1890s in order to try. Because now you can get an online amazing array of newspapers, and I was trying to get to the truth of a particular story, and I found it being repeated in many different places. But the actual happening was quite obscure. It happened in present-day Bangladesh, but in each retelling, there were new facts, in inverted commas, new details, because what the journalists were doing was creating a story, a better story than the original one, and they had a monopoly on communication. You know, people couldn't find out what was happening in Bangladesh. Mm. You had to have the wireless. And through the 70s, 1970s, the 80s, and until recently, the newspaper still had a monopoly on international communications. And we couldn't create our own truths. We had to swallow theirs whole.
You know, what's very interesting, just, Lynn, about the concept of post-truth. When was the truth ever determined?
No, exactly.
To such an extent that we've now declared post-truth.
I think there was a time, though, when journalism, all presidents men, that kind of thing, you know, celebrated its own, we will fight for the truth, we will search out the truth.
Although even then they could have been living in a post-truth world. I mean, to be fair to the OED, and the reason why we're talking about this is because of that kind of swell, right, that burst of people using the term. And to be fair, they're just saying that it is a reflection of the world in which we live. So I think it's more that people are searching for a word that helps them hinge their anxieties and to say, look, this explains it. We're in post-truth.
Yeah. Mm.
Although
it's a very interesting psychological phenomenon, because it is a psychological phenomenon. You know, when you talk about all the president's men and so on, you know, Gunawan Muhammad, the Indonesian writer, had a very, very good phrase about journalism, about writing, about truth-seeking. And it was, you know, the point is not to arrive at the truth. The point is to keep pushing until the truth may emerge. The operative word here, of course, being may. Mm. Because we can't ever determine this notion of the truth. And just because we're in some kind of psychological panic, you know, we've kind of moved on to post-truth.
Mm. I think we're just searching for that word. And I'm not sure how many people are using it correctly, even for that matter. But it is the word of the year, like it or not.
Right. Well, but here on A Bit of Culture, we're truth, truth. We are on the board.
We're all about that.
We're about truth. Now we move on to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that might be of interest. And I'm going to go first. And I want to recommend, I don't think I've recommended it before, Stephen Colbert, he's a talk show host now. In America, and late night show host, and I watch his, and I recommend that you watch them as well, his monologues at the beginning of his show. It's funny, it's great satire, and he has at the moment this air of I can't believe what on earth is happening, and you know the audience are with him on that. And in an earlier version of Stephen Colbert, he had a previous show, and he invented in that show the word truthiness, which is essentially the same as post-truth. But truthiness, in it, he said that he would not tell the news to you. He would feel it at you. So Stephen Colbert has been my crutch to help me try to negotiate what on earth is going on.
He's been brilliant.
Yeah.
Very piercing. Yeah. Very funny, very piercing.
Very piercing, but not angry.
No, and very heartfelt. I mean, there were times where I teared up just watching him kind of tear up. And Stephen Colbert, that's an excellent recommendation.
Yeah. Edin.
Well, I'll have to go something Leonard Cohen, but not what you would expect. If you go on YouTube and look up an old edition of Miami Vice, Leonard Cohen makes a cameo appearance. Yeah, yeah. The TV, Don Johnson and the other guy, Paul, whatever his name is. There's a cameo by Leonard Cohen, and he plays a mafia boss. And he's a really, really kind of oily, tacky mafia boss. And, you know, one of the great things is that Leonard Cohen had a tremendous sense of humor. He was very, very funny. You know, you have this sense of the bits of depressive poet and songwriter. And on the one hand, you know, just incredibly precious. One opinion is that he's incredibly just elevated and, you know, untouchable. The other aspect of him is, of course, that some people feel he comes across with very cheesy lines. The Miami Vice cameo, I think, was a nice parody on the cheesy lines, you know, kind of tacky individual. So it's really good for a laugh. And I think it really shows the breadth of his spirit.
Because Miami Vice is created by Michael Mann, who has very much pretensions to greater things. Mm. So he must have brought in Leonard Cohen for that. Actually, my favorite piece of Leonard Cohen music in a film is in McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yes.
Because I think it was all Leonard Cohen, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It just reminds me of Werner Herzog being a villain in a Tom Cruise movie.
He was very good in that.
He was very good at that. It's just an odd thing.
Yeah, very good. And Lynn, what's yours?
Okay, I am going to go with, I don't know if it's been recommended on the show yet, BBC Planet Earth. Has anybody recommended that?
Oh, no.
Well, season 2 is out, and if you ever need to feel a little bit better about the world, I can't recommend it highly enough. I think it's really must-see TV. It's narrated by David Attenborough. It was shot over 10 years. They use drones. They've got all these different technologies. And the way it's shot is just stupendous. There are moments that I don't know what I'm looking at. I can't believe what I'm looking at. It is an honor to kind of imagine that creature somewhere on Earth drawing breath, you know, on the same Earth that I'm on. It's incredible. And they've been splitting it up into... So episode 1 was islands. We've gone through islands, mountains. The most recent one is jungles. Next week is deserts. And islands has all the drama you could ever want in the world. It has an albatross who's waiting for his mate to come back and he's not sure if she will. There is a baby iguana escaping from a mass of snakes. There are all these wonderful things. And it's just... incredible storytelling. BBC Planet Earth season 2. Binge it.
I can't tell you how many elegiac moments of my life have been narrated by David Attenborough.
I know. If he narrated everything, we wouldn't be this sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you must watch on the most high definition equipment, television, everything that you can possibly get your hands on.
Everything. It's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And now we're gonna close up now. But before we do so, I'm just going to say that we're going to play out with a piece of music. But I'm afraid it's not going to be Leonard Cohen.
Silly.
No, because we did the other day. I'd like us to play out with a bit of Hamilton. Yes, Lynn.
Oh.
I thought I'd... I just...
Okay.
Right. And you... And
this
you,
is sad. I know you're throwing me a bone, and yet I'm this pathetically happy.
Right.
It's troubling.
And you're going to choose the piece. Have a think about it, and then...
I've got it.
Oh, okay.
I have got it in my head.
All right.
Okay. I think the best song to encapsulate Hamilton is the first... is the finale of the first act, which is called Nonstop. And it's a summation of all the themes and all the threads of the story. It showcases how many different musical styles there are in the single musical. It is so incredible. I dance to it. It's called Nonstop. It's so good.
Okay. So only remains me now to thank special honored guest Eden Koo.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Lovely
much.
Being here.
Lee Chulin.
Thank you.
And myself, Cam Rastan. You can get in touch with us on our Facebook page. Please like it. We're up to 100,000. Also, Twitter feeds were across the things. Are you still Instagramming?
Lynn? I'm still, well, sporadically, meh.
I occasionally get little things saying, Lee Chui Lin has posted a thing for the first time in a long time, it says.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm happy with that, actually.
I don't know, it tells me that. Eden, are you Twittering you still?
Oh, I have a Twitter account, which I started hoping to tweet rhyming couplets every morning, but I've never ever used it.
Okay.
It's 3 years old now.
But you are on Facebook, I know that.
Yes, on Facebook.
Okay. So please join us next week for another exciting episode of Bit of Culture as we play out with Nonstop from the musical Hamilton here on BFM 89.9.
After the war, I went back to New York. After the war, I went back to New York. I feel finished up my studies and I practiced law.
I practiced law, Burr worked next door.
Even though we started at the very same time, Alexander Hamilton began to climb. How to account for his rise to the top? Man, the man is nonstop.
Gentlemen of the jury, I'm curious, bear with me. Are you aware that we're making history? This is the first murder trial of our brand new nation. The liberty behind the liberation. I intend to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt with my assistant counsel.
Co-counsel Hamilton, sit down. A client, Larry Weeks, is innocent. Call your first witness. That's all you had to say.
Okay, one more thing.
Why do you assume you're the smartest in the room? Why do you assume you're the smartest in the room? Why do you assume you're the smartest in the room? Soon that attitude may be your doom.
Why do you write like you're running out of time?
Write day and night like you're running out of time.
Every day you fight like you're running out of time.
Keep on fighting in the meantime.
Non-stop.
Corruption's such an old song that we can sing along in harmony. And nowhere is it stronger than in Albany. This colony's economy's increasingly stalling. And honestly, that's why public service just seems to be calling
non-stop.
It. I practiced the law, practically perfected it. I've seen injustice in the world and I've corrected it. Now for a strong central democracy. If not, then I'll be Socrates throwing verbal rocks at these mediocrities.
Hamilton at the Constitutional Convention.
I was chosen for the Constitutional Convention.
There is a New York junior delegate.
Now what I'm gonna say may sound indelicate.
He goes and proposes his own form of government.
What?
His own plan for a new form of government.
What?
Talks for 6 hours. The convention is listless.
Bright young man.
Yo, who the F is this?
Why do you always say what you believe?
Why do you always say what you believe?
Every proclamation guarantees free ammunition for your enemies.
Why do you write like it's going out of style? Write day and night like it's going out of style. Every day you fight like it's going out of style. Do what you do.
Alexander?
Aaron Burr, sir.
Well, it's the middle of the night.
Can we confer, sir?
Is this a legal matter?
Yes, and it's important to me.
What do you need?
Burr, you're a better lawyer than me.
Okay.
I know I talk too much. I'm abrasive. You're incredible in court. You're succinct, persuasive. My client needs a strong defense. You're the solution.
Who's your client?
The new U.S. Constitution?
No.
Hear me out.
No way.
A series of essays anonymously published defending the document to the public.
No one will read it.
I disagree.
And if it fails?
Burr, that's why we need it.
The Constitution's a mess.
So it needs amendments?
It's full of contradictions.
So is independence. We have to start somewhere.
No. No way.
You're making a mistake.
Good night.
Hey, what are you waiting for? What do you stall for?
What?
We won the war. What was it all for? Do you support this Constitution?
Of course.
Then defend it.
And what if you're backing the wrong horse?
Burr, we studied and we fought and we killed for the notion of a nation we now get to build. For once in your life, take a stand with pride. I don't understand how you stand to the side.
I'll keep all my hands close to my chest.
Accompanied by someone who always pays. I have found a wealthy husband who will keep me in comfort for all my days. He is not a lot of fun, but there's no one who can match you for turn of phrase. My Alexander,
Jacob.
Don't forget to ride. Look at where you are. Look at where you started. The fact that you're alive is a miracle. To stay alive, that would be enough. Peace of mind. Would that be enough?
Alexander joins forces with James Madison and John Jay to write a series of essays defending the new United States Constitution entitled The Federalist Papers. The plan was to write a total of 25 essays, the work divided evenly among the three men. In the end, they wrote 85 essays in the span of 6 months. John Jay got sick after writing 5. James Madison wrote 29. Hamilton wrote the other 51. How do you write like you're running out of time? Write day and night like you're running out of time. Every day you fight like you're running out of time. Like you're running out of time. Are you running out of time?
How do you write like tomorrow won't arrive? How do you write like you needed to survive?
How do you write every second you're alive? Every second you're alive. Every second you're alive. They're asking me
best I can to get the people that I need. I'm asking you to be my right hand,
Treasury
man.
Or state.
I know it's a lot to
Treasury
ask
or state.
To leave behind the world you know.
Sir, do you want me to run the Treasury or State Department?
Treasury. Let's go.
Alexander.
I have to leave.
Alexander.
Look around at how lucky we are to be alive right now.
Helpless.
They are asking me to leave.
Look around.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.